Anne can imagine Cynthia as a schoolyard bully, the tall, beautiful girl who taunted short, plump, underconfident girls like her. "Yes, I want to know. Are you sure? Because once I tell you, I'm not going to be able to take it back." Cynthia puts her cup down on the table. "I'm stronger than you think," Anne says. There's an edge to her voice. She puts her cup down, too, leans forward over the table and says, "I've lost my baby. What could possibly hurt me now?" Cynthia smiles, but it's a cold, calculating smile. She sits back in her chair and looks at Anne as if she is trying to make a decision. "I don't think you have any idea what's really going on," she says.
"Then why don't you tell me?" Anne snaps.
Cynthia stands up, pushes back her chair with a scrape on the kitchen floor. "All right. Stay here. I'll only be gone for a minute." Cynthia leaves the kitchen and goes upstairs. Anne wonders what Cynthia can possibly have to show her. She considers making a run for it. How much reality can she stand? Maybe there are pictures. Pictures of her and Marco together. Cynthia is a photographer, and Cynthia is the kind of woman to have pictures taken of herself, because she is so gorgeous and so vain. Maybe she's going to show Anne pictures of herself in bed with Marco, and the expression on Marco's face will be entirely different from the expression on his face when he's making love to Anne. She stands up. She's about to let herself out the sliding glass door when Cynthia appears in the kitchen holding a laptop. "Losing your nerve?" she asks. "No, I just wanted some air," Anne lies, sliding the door closed again and turning back to the table. Cynthia puts the laptop on the table and opens it up. They sit down and wait a couple of minutes until it boots up. Cynthia says to her, "I'm really sorry about this, Anne. I really am." Anne glares at her, not believing her for a second, then turns her reluctant attention to the screen. It isn't what she expected. It's a black-and-white video of Cynthia's backyard and, beyond that, Anne's own backyard. She notes the date and time stamp on the bottom. She goes utterly cold. "Wait for it," Cynthia says. She's going to see that dead man taking her child. Cynthia is that cruel. And Cynthia has had a video of it the whole time. "Why didn't you show this to the police?" Anne demands, her eyes locked on the video, waiting. In disbelief, Anne sees Marco appear at their back door at 12:31 and twist the light bulb on the motion detector. The light goes out. Anne feels all the blood leaving her extremities. She sees Marco go into the house. 2 minutes pass. Then the back door opens. Marco is coming out of the house with Cora in his arms, wrapped in her white blanket. He glances around as if to see whether he's being observed, looks right into the camera, and then he walks quickly to the garage and lets himself in through the door. Anne's heart is banging wildly against her ribs. A minute later, she sees Marco come out of the garage without the baby. It is 12:34. He walks across the lawn toward the house, where his image disappears from view briefly and then reappears on the Stillwell's back patio. "So you see, Anne," Cynthia says into the shocked silence, "it's not about Marco and me having an affair. Marco kidnapped your baby." Anne is stunned, horrified, and cannot answer. Cynthia says, "You might want to ask him where she is."
31.
Cynthia settles comfortably in her chair and says, "I could take this to the police, or maybe you'd prefer that I don't. You're from money, aren't you?" Anne bolts. She pulls open the sliding door and flees, leaving Cynthia sitting alone at the table with the laptop. The image of Marco carrying Cora to their garage at 12:33 in the morning has been seared into Anne's retinas and deep into her brain. She will never get that image out of her head. Marco took their baby. He's been lying to her all this time. She doesn't know who she married. She runs to her own house and in through the back door. She can hardly breathe. She sinks to the floor in the kitchen, leaning against the bottom cupboards, sobbing and shaking. She cries and gasps for breath and sees the same images in her head over and over again. This changes everything. Marco took their baby. But why? Why did he do it? It can't be that Cora was already dead and he did it to protect her. Detective Razback has already explained to her how that simply wasn't possible. If she'd killed Cora and Marco had discovered it at 12:30, he could not have had an accomplice there by 12:35. And she now knows that he took Cora out of the house at exactly 12:33. He must have arranged for someone, for the dead man, to be waiting in his car in the garage at 12:30, when Marco knew he would be checking on Cora. So he planned this. He planned it. With this man, who is now dead. The man she thinks she's seen before. Where has she seen him? Marco was behind the whole thing all along, and she knew nothing about it. Marco abducted their baby with this other man who is now dead. Where is her baby now? Who took her from the man in the cabin? What the hell happened? How could he? Anne sits on the kitchen floor, hugging her knees, trying to figure it out. She thinks about going back to the police station and telling Detective Razback what she's seen. He could get the video from Cynthia. She can guess why Cynthia hadn't taken it to the police in the first place. She must be holding it over Marco. She wants to have him in her power. That's the kind of woman Cynthia is. Why would Marco kidnap Cora? If he didn't do it to protect Anne, he did it for his own selfish reasons. The only possible reason is money. He wanted the ransom money. Her parents' money. It is an appalling realization. She knows now that the business isn't doing well. She remembers that Marco had her sign mortgage papers on the house a few months ago to get liquid capital for further expansion plans. She thought the business was growing faster than expected, that everything was fine. But maybe he'd been lying then, too. It's all fitting together. The business going belly up, mortgaging the house, and finally arranging the kidnapping of his own child from her parents. Why didn't Marco just tell her about his business troubles? They could have gone to her parents, asked for more money. Why did he do such a stupid thing? Why would he take their precious baby and hand her over to that man who was beaten to death with a shovel? Did Marco go up to that cabin after the ransom money was taken, confront the man and kill him in a rage? Was Marco a murderer, too? Would he have had time to get all the way out to the cabin and back without her noticing? She tries to remember what day it is, tries to review every single day that's passed since the kidnapping, but it's all a hopeless jumble in her head. Was the cell phone part of this? She realizes that she has been wrong from the start. This is not about affairs with Cynthia or anyone else. This is about the kidnapping. Marco kidnapped their daughter, the man she married. And then he sat there, in their kitchen, and told her that the dead man looked familiar. She's suddenly afraid of her own husband. She doesn't know who he is or what he is. She is starting to understand what he's capable of. Had he ever loved her? Or had he only married her for her money? What does she do now? Does she go to the police with what she knows? What might happen to Cora if she did? After a long time, Anne pulls herself up off the floor. She forces herself to walk quickly upstairs to the bedroom. Trembling, she pulls out an overnight bag and starts packing. Anne gets out of the cab at the foot of her parents' circular gravel drive. This is the house she grew up in. It is very grand, the large stone house with its lush, professionally tended gardens, backs onto a wooded ravine. She pays the cab driver and stands there for a minute with her overnight bag at her feet, looking at the house. The homes are set far apart here. Nobody will see her, unless her mother is home and happens to look out the window. She remembers vividly the day she stepped out of this house and climbed onto the back of Marco's motorcycle and decided that she was in love. So much has happened. So much has changed. She hates to go back to her parents. It's an admission that they were right about Marco all along. She doesn't want to believe it, but she's seen the evidence with her own eyes. She'd gone against their wishes when she'd married Marco. She'd known her own mind then and her own heart. Now she doesn't know anything. There at the end of her parents' drive, from out of nowhere, Anne suddenly remembers where she saw the dead man. She trembles like a leaf in the wind, trying to make sense of this new information. Then she takes out her cell phone and calls another cab. Marco tries Richard again, leaves another terse message on his voicemail. Richard is punishing him, keeping him out of the loop. He's going to handle it himself and not let Marco know until it's all over, when Cora is back, safe and sound. If she does come back. Even Marco admits to himself that maybe it's better this way. If anyone can pull this off, it's Richard. Richard, with his bags of money and nerves of steel. Marco is exhausted, physically and emotionally. He wants nothing more than to lie down on his office couch, sleep for a few hours, and wake up to a phone call that Cora is home again, safe. But then, what happens after that? He remembers there's an open bottle of scotch in the back of one of his filing cabinet drawers. He stops pacing, moves over to the filing cabinet, and pulls open the drawer. The bottle is half empty. He grabs a glass, also hidden in the filing cabinet, and pours himself a stiff one. Then he resumes his pacing. Marco can't face the possibility of never seeing Cora again. He is also terrified of being arrested and going to prison. He's sure that if he is arrested, the lawyer most likely to be able to get him acquitted, Aubrey West, will no longer be acting for him, because Anne's parents won't pay, and Marco doesn't have the money to pay for a top-notch lawyer himself. He refills his glass from the bottle, which is now sitting open on the blotter on his expensive desk, and realizes that he's already thinking about what to do after he's arrested. Arrest now seems inevitable. Anne won't stand by him, not once she hears the truth from her own father. Why would she? She'll hate him. If she had done this to him, he would never forgive her. Then there's Cynthia and the video. His nose deep into his third drink, Marco, for the first time, considers telling the police the truth. What if he simply told Razback that, yes, he met with Bruce, who turned out to be Derek Honig? Yes, he had business troubles. Yes, his father-in-law refused to help him out. Yes, he planned to take and hide his own baby for a couple of days to get the ransom money out of his wife's parents. But it wasn't actually his idea. It was Derek Honig's idea. Derek Honig was the one who suggested it. He planned it. In Marco's mind, it was just a way to get a bit of an advance on his wife's inheritance. No one was supposed to die, not his accomplice, certainly not his baby. Marco was a victim in this, too. Not blameless, but still a victim. He was desperate, and he fell in with someone who gave him a false name, who manipulated him into the kidnapping for his own gain. A good lawyer like Aubrey West could spin it. Marco could come clean with Detective Razback, tell him everything. Once Cora is back home. He would go to prison, but Cora, if she survives this, would be with her mother. Richard would no longer have anything to hold over him, and Cynthia would be shit out of luck. Maybe he could even make sure she went to jail for attempted blackmail. For a minute he imagined Cynthia in a shapeless orange jumpsuit with unwashed hair. He looks up from his pacing. Catches his reflection in the large mirror hanging on the wall across from the window, and barely recognizes himself. 32. Marco finally returns home once it's dark. He's had too much to drink, so he leaves the car behind and takes a cab. He arrives home, disheveled, his eyes bloodshot, his body racked with tension, even with all the alcohol in it. He lets himself in the front door. "Anne?" he calls, wondering where she is. The house is dark and feels empty. It's very quiet. He stands still, listening to the silence. Maybe she isn't here. "Anne?" His voice is louder now, worried. He walks farther into the living room. He stops when he sees her. Anne is sitting on the sofa in the dark, utterly still. There is a large knife in her hands. Marco recognizes it as the carving knife from the wooden block on their kitchen counter. The blood drops from his heart and pools in his feet. He takes a cautious step forward and tries to see her more closely. What is she doing, sitting in the dark with a knife? Anne, Marco says more quietly. She appears to be in some kind of trance. She's scaring him. Anne, what happened? He speaks to her the way someone might try to talk to a dangerous animal. When she doesn't answer him, he asks, in the same gentle voice, "What are you doing with the knife?" He needs to turn on the light. He moves slowly toward the lamp on the side table. "Don't come near me!" She holds up the knife. Marco stops in his tracks, staring at her, at the way she's holding the knife, as if she means to use it. "I know what you did," she says in a low, desperate voice. Marco thinks quickly. Anne must have been talking to her father. Things must have gone horribly wrong. Marco is flooded with despair. He realizes how much he was relying on his father-in-law to save the day, to get Cora back for them. But clearly everything has fallen apart. Their baby is gone forever, and Anne's father has told her the truth. And now this last part, this final piece, his wife has lost her mind. "What's with the knife, Anne?" Marco asks, forcing his voice to stay calm. "It's for protection."
"Protection from who?"
"From you."
"You don't need protection from me," Marco says to her in the dark. What has her father been telling her? What lies? He would never intentionally harm his wife or child. It's all been a terrible mistake. She has no reason to be afraid of him.
You're dangerous, Marco, with your plans and schemes.
Have you seen your father?
No.
But you've talked to him?
No.
Marco doesn't understand. Who have you been talking to?
No one.
Why are you sitting here in the dark with a knife? He wants to turn on the light, but doesn't want to startle her.
"That's not true," Anne says, as if remembering. "I did see Cynthia."
Marco is silent, terrified.
"She showed me the video."
The look she gives him is terrible. All her pain and rage shows on her face, her hatred. Marco sags. He feels like his knees will give way. It's all over now. Maybe Anne wants to kill him for stealing their baby. He can't blame her. He wants to grab the knife and do it himself. Suddenly he goes cold. He needs to see the knife. He needs to know if she's used it. But it's too dark. He can't see her well enough to see if there's blood on her or on the knife. He takes another step toward her and stops. Her eyes terrify him. She says,
"You kidnapped Cora. I saw it with my own eyes. You carried her out of the house, wrapped in her blanket, and took her to the garage. That man took her away. You planned the whole thing. You lied to me, and you kept on lying to me all this time."
Her voice is disbelieving.
"And then, when he double-crossed you, you went to that cabin and beat him to death with a shovel."
She's more animated now. Marco is horrified. "No, Anne, I didn't."
"And then you sat at the kitchen table with me and said he looked familiar."
Marco feels sick. He thinks of how it must seem to her, how twisted everything has become. Anne leans forward. She is holding the large knife tightly with both hands.
"I've been living with you in this house this whole time since Cora was taken, and all along you've been lying to me, lying about everything."
She stares at him and whispers,
"I don't know who you are."
Marco keeps his eyes on the knife and says desperately, "I did take her. I did take her, Anne, but it's not what you think. I don't know what Cynthia told you. She doesn't know anything about it. She's blackmailing me. She's trying to use the video to get money out of me." Anne stares at him, her eyes huge in the dark.
"I can explain, Anne. It's not how it looks. Listen to me. I got into financial trouble. The business wasn't going well. I had some reversals. And then I met this man, this Derek Honig."
Marco falters. He told me his name was Bruce Nealand. He seemed like a nice guy. We became friends. He suggested the kidnapping. It was all his idea. I needed the money. He said it would be fast and easy, that no one would get hurt. He planned the whole thing.
Marco pauses for breath. She is staring at him, her eyes grim. Even so, it is a relief to confess, to tell her the truth.
I took Cora out to him in the garage. He was supposed to call us within 12 hours, and we were supposed to get her back in 2 or 3 days at most. It was supposed to be so fast and easy, Marco says bitterly. But then we didn't hear from him. I didn't know what was happening. I tried to call him with that cell phone you found. That's what it was for. But he didn't answer my calls. I didn't know what to do. I had no other way to reach him. I thought that maybe he'd lost the cell phone, or that he'd gotten cold feet, that maybe he'd killed her and left the country.
His voice has become a sob. He pauses to regain control.
I was panicking. It's been absolute hell for me too, Anne. You've no idea. Don't tell me I have no idea, Anne screams at him. Because of you, our baby is gone.
He tries to calm her by lowering his voice. He has to tell her everything. He has to get it out.
And then, when we got the onesie in the mail, I thought it was him, reaching out, that maybe something had happened to the cell and he was afraid to call me directly. I thought he was trying to get her back to us. Even when he increased the ransom to 5 million, I didn't think he would double-cross me. I was only worried that your parents might not pay. I thought maybe he'd upped the stakes because he felt the risk had increased.
Marco stops talking for a minute, overwhelmed by reliving it all.
But then when I got there, Cora wasn't there.
He breaks down, sobbing.
She was supposed to be there. I don't know what happened. Anne, I swear to you, I never meant for anyone to get hurt, especially not Cora. Or you.
He's dropped down onto his knees on the floor in front of her. She could slit his throat now if she chose. He doesn't care.
How could you?
Anne whispers.
How could you be so stupid?
Marco lifts his head miserably and looks at her.
Why didn't you ask my father for money if you needed it so badly?
I did, Marco says wildly, but he turned me down.
I don't believe you. He wouldn't do that.
Why would I lie?
You do nothing but lie, Marco.
Ask him then. They glare at each other for a moment. Then Marco says, more quietly,
You have every reason to hate me, Anne. I hate myself for what I did. But you don't need to be afraid of me.
Not even after you beat that man to death with a spade?
I didn't.
Why don't you tell me everything, Marco?
I have told you everything. I did not kill that man in the cabin.
Then who did?
If we knew that, we'd know who has Cora. Derek wouldn't have hurt Cora, I'm sure of it. He would never have hurt her. I would never have let him have her if I thought he would.
But saying this, Marco is appalled at how easily he let someone else have his daughter. He'd been so desperate that he'd blinded himself to the risks. But that was nothing to the desperation he feels now. Why would Derek harm Cora? He would have no reason to, unless he panicked.
Marco says, He just wanted to make the exchange and get his money and disappear. Someone else must have found out he had her, then killed him and taken her, and then they cheated us.
He pleads with her,
Anne, you have to believe me. I did not kill him. How could I? You know I've been here with you most of the time or at the office. I couldn't have killed him.
Anne is silent, considering. Then she whispers,
I don't know what to believe.
That's why I went to the police, Marco explains. I told them I'd seen him hanging around the house, so they'd investigate him. I wanted to point the police in the right direction so they could find out who killed him, to find Cora without giving myself away. But as usual, they've come up empty. He adds, his voice defeated, although it's probably just a matter of time until they arrest me.
They'll arrest you really fast if they see that tape, Anne mutters bitterly.
Marco looks at her. He doesn't know if she would prefer that the police arrest him or not. It's hard to read her now.
I did take Cora and hand her over to Derek. We did try to get money from your parents. But I didn't kill Derek. I couldn't kill anybody, I swear to you.
He puts a tender hand on her knee. Anne, let me have the knife. She looks at the knife in her hands as if she doesn't know it's there. No matter what he's done, what havoc he's wreaked, he does not want to be responsible for any more harm. Her manner is disturbing. He moves then and gently takes the knife from her hands. She doesn't resist. Relieved, he sees that the blade is clean. There is no blood on it. He studies her closely, looks at her wrists. There's no blood anywhere. She has not hurt herself. It was meant for him, to protect herself from him. He sets the knife down on the side table, gets up off the floor, and sits beside her on the sofa, facing her. He asks, "Have you heard from your father today?" "No, but I went to my parents," Anne says.
"I thought you said you didn't see them."
"I didn't. I packed a bag. I was going to leave you," she says bitterly. "After I left Cynthia's, after I saw the video, I hated you for what you did." Her voice is agitated again. "And I thought you were a murderer. I was afraid of you."
"I can understand why you'd hate me, Anne. I understand that you'll never forgive me." He chokes on the words.
"But you don't need to be afraid of me. I'm not a murderer." She turns her face away as if she can't bear to look at him. She says, "I went to my parents, but I didn't go in."
"Why not?"
"Because I remembered where I'd seen that man before, the dead man."
"You've seen him before?" Marco asks in surprise.
She turns her head and looks at him again.
"I told you." She had, but he hadn't really believed her. At the time, he'd just thought it was the power of suggestion. "Where did you see him?"
"It was a long time ago," she whispers. "He's a friend of my father's."
33. Marco freezes. "Are you sure?"
"Yes."
She sounds strange, not like herself. Can he trust anything she says? Marco thinks rapidly. Richard and Derek Honig. The cell phone. Was this whole thing a setup? Has Richard been controlling this nightmare from behind the scenes? Has Richard had Cora all along?
"I'm sure I've seen him with my father when I was younger," Anne says. "He knows him. Why would my father know the man who took our baby, Marco? Don't you think that's strange?"
She sounds like she's drifting away. "It's strange, all right," Marco says slowly. He remembers his suspicions when he'd used the secret cell phone and his father-in-law had answered. Was this the missing link? Honig had approached him out of the blue. He had befriended Marco, listened to his troubles. He got Marco to trust him. He urged Marco to ask Richard for more money, and then Richard turned him down. What if they were in collusion, and Richard had turned down his request for more money, knowing that Honig would be there, waiting to pick up the pieces? Honig had suggested the kidnapping that same day. What if this had all been carefully orchestrated by Marco's father-in-law? Marco feels ill. If so, he has been even more duped than he thought, and by the man he most dislikes in the world. "Anne," Marco says, and then the words spill out in a rush. "Derek Honig found me. He befriended me. He urged me to ask your father for more money. Then, the day your father turned me down for another loan, he showed up again as if he knew. It was like he knew I'd be desperate. That's when he suggested the kidnapping." Marco feels as if he's emerging from a bad dream, that things are finally starting to make sense. "What if your father is behind this, Anne?" he says urgently. "I think he got Honig to approach me, to set me up for the kidnapping. I've been played, Anne." "No," Anne says stubbornly. "I can't believe it. My father would never do that. Why would he? What possible reason could he have?" It wounds Marco that she seems to have no difficulty believing that he could murder a man with a spade in cold blood, yet can't believe that her father would set him up. But he must remember that she's seen that damning video. That would shatter the faith of anyone. He must tell her the rest. "Anne, the cell phone, in the duct, the one Honig and I were using. What about it? After you found it, I noticed that there were some missed calls. Someone had called from Honig's cell phone, so I called the number again. And your father answered. She looks at him in disbelief. Anne, he was expecting it to be me on the other end of the phone. He knew I'd taken Cora. I asked him how he got the phone. He said the kidnappers had mailed it to him with a note, like the onesie. He said the kidnappers got in touch with him because it was in the newspapers that your parents were the ones who'd paid the ransom. He said they were asking for more money for Cora, that he was going to pay it, but he made me promise not to tell you. He said he didn't want to get your hopes up, in case it all fell apart. What? Anne's face, dazed with suffering, now comes to life. He's been in touch with the kidnappers? Marco nods. He said he was going to deal with them and get her back himself, because I'd fucked it all up. When was this? Anne asks breathlessly. Last night. And you didn't tell me? He made me promise not to, in case things don't work out. I've been trying to reach him all day, but he won't call me back. I've been going out of my mind, not knowing what's happening. I assume he hasn't gotten her back, or we would have heard something. But now Marco sees it differently. He's been played by a master. But, Anne, what if your father has known where Cora is all along? Anne looks like she can't take in any more. She looks numb. Finally, her voice breaking, she asks, "But why would he do that?" Marco knows why. "Because your parents hate me," Marco says. "They want to destroy me, destroy our marriage, and get you and Cora back for themselves." Anne shakes her head. "I know they don't like you. Maybe they even hate you. But what you're saying? I can't believe it. What if he's telling the truth? What if the kidnappers are in touch with my parents and he's trying to get her back for us?" The hope in her voice is heartrending. Marco says, "But you just said that your father knows Derek Honig. That can't be a coincidence." There's a long pause. Then she whispers, "Did he kill Derek Honig with the shovel?" "Maybe," Marco says uncertainly. "I don't know."
"What about Cora?" Anne whispers. "What's happened to her?"
Marco takes her by the shoulders and looks into her eyes, which are big and frightened. "I think your father must have her, or he knows who does."
"What are we going to do?"
Anne whispers. "We have to think this through," Marco says. He gets up from the sofa, too anxious to sit still. "If your father does have her, or knows where she is, we have two options. We can go directly to the police, or we can confront him." Anne stares into space, as if her mind has become overwhelmed. "Maybe we should talk to your father first, rather than going to the police," Marco says uneasily. Marco doesn't want to go to jail.
"If we go to my father," Anne says, "I can talk to him. He'll give Cora back to me. He'll be sorry. I know he will. He just wants me to be happy."
Marco stops pacing and looks at his wife, questioning her grip on reality. If it's true that Derek Honig was a friend of her father's, then it could well be true that her father manipulated Marco into financial desperation, into kidnapping their child. Her father might have orchestrated the deception at the exchange. He might have murdered a man in cold blood. He has caused his daughter intense pain. He doesn't care if she's happy. He just wants things his way. He is utterly ruthless. For the first time, Marco realizes what an adversary he has in his father-in-law. The man is possibly a sociopath. How many times had Richard told him that to succeed in business, one had to be ruthless? Maybe that was it. Maybe he was trying to teach Marco a lesson about ruthlessness. Anne says suddenly,
"Maybe my father is not part of this. Maybe Derek befriended you and manipulated you because he knew my father and knew he has money. But my father might not know anything about it. He might not know that Derek was the kidnapper. He might have gotten the phone and the note in the mail, like he said."
She seems more lucid again. Marco thinks about this. It's possible. But he believes that Richard is running things behind the scenes. He feels it in his gut.
"We have to go over there,"
Anne says, but you can't just barge in and accuse him. We don't know for sure what's going on. I can tell him that I know you took Cora and that you gave her to Derek Honig, that we need his help getting her back. If my father is involved in this, we have to give him a way out. We have to pretend he had nothing to do with it, beg him to work with the kidnappers, to figure out how to get Cora back to us. Marco thinks about what she's said and nods. Anne seems more like herself again, and he's relieved. Besides, she's right. Richard Dries isn't the kind of man you back into a corner. The important thing is to get Cora home again. And maybe my father isn't behind it at all. Maybe he really is in touch with the kidnappers, Anne says. She so obviously wants to believe that her father wouldn't do this to her. I doubt it. They sit for a moment, exhausted by all that's happened, steeling themselves for what's ahead. Finally, Marco says, "We'd better get going." Anne nods. She puts a hand on his arm as they're leaving. "Promise me you won't lose your cool with my father," she says. What can Marco do but say yes? "I promise." He adds miserably, "I owe you that." They take a cab to Anne's parents' home, passing by increasingly stately houses until they arrive in the wealthiest suburb of the city. It's late, but they have not called first. They want the element of surprise on their side. Anne and Marco sit in the back of the taxi, saying nothing. Marco can feel Anne trembling against him. Her breathing sounds fast and shallow. He takes her hand in his to calm her. He is sweating with nerves in the hot, sticky cab. The air conditioning doesn't seem to be working. Marco puts the window down a bit so that he can breathe. The cab drives them up the circular gravel drive and stops at the front door. Marco pays the driver and tells him not to wait. Anne presses the bell. There are still lights on in the house. After a moment, Anne's mother opens the door. "Anne," she says, clearly surprised. "I wasn't expecting you." Anne pushes past her mother and Marco follows her into the front hall, and at once all their plans fly out the window. "Where is she?" Anne demands. She looks wildly at her mother. Her mother seems stunned and doesn't answer. Anne starts walking rapidly through the large house, leaving Marco standing in the front hall, horrified by her behavior. Anne has lost it. He wonders how to play this now. Anne's mother follows after her on her frantic search through the house. Marco can hear Anne calling, "Cora! Cora!" He senses movement above and looks up. Richard is coming down the grand staircase. Their eyes meet, steel on steel. They can both hear Anne's cries. "Where is she? Where is my baby?" Her voice is becoming more and more frantic. Suddenly, Marco questions everything. Was Anne right about recognizing Derek Honig? Was Derek an associate of her father's, or has her brain supplied a detail that is simply a delusion? He found her at home in the dark, holding a knife. How reliable is anything she says? Everything he believes hinges on Richard's knowing Derek Honig. Now it's up to Marco to find out the truth. "Let's go sit down, shall we?" Richard says, and passes him on his way to the living room. Marco follows. His mouth is dry. He is afraid. He may not be dealing with a normal person here. Richard is, quite possibly, a sociopath. Marco knows he's out of his depth. He doesn't know how to handle this situation, and everything depends on how he handles it. Marco hears Anne's footsteps. She is running now, up the elaborate staircase to the second floor. He and Richard stare at each other, listening to Anne call Cora's name as she flings back bedroom doors, running along the upstairs hall, searching. "She won't find her," Richard says. "Where is she, you son of a bitch?" Marco says. He has gone off script, too. None of this is going according to plan. "Well, she's not here," his father-in-law says coldly. "Why don't we just wait for Anne to settle down, and we can all have a meeting?" It takes everything Marco has not to get up and go for his father-in-law's fat throat. He forces himself to sit down and to wait for what's coming. Finally, Anne bursts into the living room, her overwrought mother right behind her.
"Where is she?"
Anne cries at her father. Her face is mottled and streaked with tears. She is hysterical.
"Sit down, Anne," her father says firmly.
Marco gestures for her to join him, and Anne goes and sits beside him on the large, overstuffed sofa.
"You know why we're here," Marco begins. "Anne seems to think that Cora is here."
"Why would she think that?" Richard asks, feigning bewilderment.
"Marco, did you tell her the kidnappers were in touch with me? I specifically asked you not to."
Marco tries to speak, but he doesn't know how to begin. Richard cuts him off anyway. He is standing by the enormous fireplace. He turns to Anne.
"I'm so sorry, Anne, but the kidnappers have let us all down. Again. I'd hoped to have Cora back tonight, but they didn't show up. I brought the additional money, as arranged, but they just didn't show."
He turns to Marco.
"Of course, I didn't let them have the money anyway, the way you did, Marco."
Marco's anger flares. Richard can't resist the temptation to make Marco look like an incompetent fool.
"I told you not to tell her to avoid this kind of distress," Richard says.
He turns to Anne again, his eyes sympathetic.
"I've done everything I can to get her back for you, Anne. I'm so sorry. But I promise you, I won't give up."
Anne sags beside him. Marco watches Richard. The coldness he exhibited to Marco switched to warmth once he's talking to his daughter. Marco sees the flicker of uncertainty in Anne's eyes. She wants to believe her father would never hurt her.
Richard says, "I'm sorry your mother and I didn't tell you earlier, Anne, but we were afraid this might happen. We didn't want to get your hopes up again. The kidnappers got in touch with us and demanded more money. We'd pay anything to get Cora back. You know that. I went out to meet with them, but no one came."
He shakes his head in evident frustration and sorrow.
"It's true," Alice says, sitting down at the other end of the sofa beside her daughter. "We're just devastated."
She begins to cry, holds her arms out, and Anne sinks into her mother's embrace and begins to sob uncontrollably, her shoulders heaving.
Marco thinks, "This can't be happening." "The only thing left to do, I'm afraid," Richard says, "is to go to the police. With everything."
He turns and looks at Marco, giving him a cold stare. Marco stares back.
"Tell them, Anne, what you know," he says, but she looks at him from her mother's embrace as if she's already forgotten.
Desperately, Marco says, "The man who was murdered, Derek Honig, the police know that he took Cora from our place, that he took her to his cabin in the Catskills. But I'm sure you know this already."
Richard shrugs. "The police don't tell me anything."
"Anne recognized him," Marco says flatly. Has Richard just gone a little paler? Marco can't be sure.
"So, who was he?"
"She recognized him as a friend of yours. How is it, Richard, that a friend of yours had our baby?"
"He wasn't a friend of mine. I've never heard of him," Richard says smoothly. "Anne must be mistaken."
"I don't think so," Marco says. Anne says nothing. Marco looks at her, but her eyes are turned away. Is she betraying him? Is she going to side with her father and hang him out to dry? Because she believes her father over him? Or because she is willing to sacrifice him to get her baby back? He feels the ground shifting under his feet.
"Anne," Richard says, "do you think this murdered man, the man who supposedly had Cora, was a friend of mine?"
She regards her father, sits up straighter, and says, "No." Marco looks at her in dismay.
"That's what I thought," Richard says, eyeing Marco. "Let's review what we know," Richard says. He turns to his daughter. "I'm sorry, Anne, but this is going to be painful for you to hear."
He sits down in his chair by the fireplace and takes a deep breath before beginning, as if to indicate that this has all been very difficult for him as well. The kidnappers got in touch with us. They had our names because the newspapers figured out that we had paid the original ransom of 5 million. The kidnappers sent us a package. In the package were a cell phone and a note. The note said that the cell phone was the one that the original kidnapper had been using to stay secretly in touch with the baby's father, who was in on the plan. I tried calling the only number programmed into the phone. There was no answer, but I kept it on me, and finally it rang. It was Marco.
"I know all about that," Anne says woodenly. "I know Marco took Cora and handed her over to Derek in our garage that night."
"You do?" her father says in surprise. "How do you know? Did Marco tell you?"
Marco stiffens, afraid that she's going to mention the video.
"Yes," Anne says, glancing at Marco. "Good for you, Marco, for being man enough to tell her," Richard says. He continues, "I don't know exactly what happened, but my guess is that someone must have murdered the man in the cabin and taken Cora, and then duped Marco at the exchange. I thought all was lost until whoever did it reached out to your mother and me."
He shakes his head regretfully.
"I don't know if they'll get in touch with us again. We can only hope."
Pushed to the limit, Marco loses control.
"This is bullshit," he cries. "You know what happened. You set this whole thing up. You knew my business wasn't going well. You sent Derek to me. You got him to suggest the kidnapping. It wasn't my idea. It was never my idea. You've been manipulating everything and everyone, especially me. Derek pushed me to ask you for more money, and then you turned me down. You knew how desperate I was. And then right after you turned me down, there he was, in my darkest moment, with his kidnapping plan. You are the mastermind behind all this. Tell me, did you bash in Derek's head?"
Anne's mother gasps.
"Because that's what I think happened," Marco presses. "You killed him. You took Cora from the cabin, or you hired someone to do it. You know where she is. You've known all along, and you're not out one goddamned penny. Because you were behind the swindle at the exchange. You had someone show up without the baby to take the money back. But you want me to go to jail."
Marco stops to catch his breath.
"Tell me, do you even care if Cora lives or dies?"
Richard looks from Marco to Anne and says,
"I think your husband is out of his mind."
34.
"Show us the note," Marco demands.
"What?"
Richard is momentarily caught off guard. "The kidnapper's note, you son of a bitch," Marco says. "Show it to us. Prove to us that you're in communication with them."
"I have the phone. I didn't keep the note," Richard says, unruffled.
"Really? What did you do with the note?" Marco asks.
"I destroyed it."
"And why would you do that?" Marco asks. It's obvious to everyone in the room that he doesn't believe there is a note, that there ever was a note.
"Because it incriminated you," Richard says. "That's how I knew it would be you on the other end of the phone."
Marco laughs, but there's no humor in it. It is a hard, disbelieving laugh, bordering on rage.
"You want us to believe that you destroyed the note because it incriminated me? Is it not your intention to have me arrested for kidnapping and keep me away from your daughter for good?" Marco asks.
"No, Marco, that has never been my intention," Richard says. "I don't know why you would think that. I have never done anything but help you. You know that."
"You're so full of shit, Richard. You threatened me on the phone. You know you did. You set up this whole thing to get rid of me. Why else would you do it?"
"So, if there was a note, you would never have destroyed it."
Marco leans forward toward Richard and says in a menacing voice, "There is no note, is there, Richard? The kidnappers aren't in touch with you because you are the kidnapper. You have Derek's phone. You took it when you killed him, or you had your people do it. You knew where he had Cora because you arranged the whole thing.
You turned on Derek, which you'd probably planned to do from the start. Tell me, what did you say you'd pay him to help you send me to jail for kidnapping? Marco sits back on the sofa. He sees Alice staring at him, horrified. Richard calmly watches Marco as the younger man accuses him. Then he turns to his daughter and says, Anne, he's making all of this up to deflect your attention from his own guilt. I had nothing to do with any of this, other than trying my best to get Cora back, and trying to protect him from the police. You're a liar, Marco says in desperation. You know where Cora is. Give her back. Look at your daughter. Look at her. Give her back her baby. Anne has lifted her head and is now looking from her husband to her father. Her face is anguished. Shall we call the police then? Richard challenges. Let them sort it all out? Marco thinks rapidly. If Anne won't admit she knows Derek was an associate of her father's, or if she's not sure, Marco doesn't have a leg to stand on. The police already see him as their prime suspect. Richard, the respected, successful businessman, can hand him over on a silver platter. Anne and her father both know that Marco took Cora from her crib and gave her to Derek. Marco still believes Richard is behind all this, but he has nothing on Richard. Marco is fucked, and they still don't have Cora. Marco believes that Richard will keep Cora hidden forever, if necessary, just so that he can win. How can Marco make Richard think he's won so that he'll give Cora back? Should Marco confess to the police? Is that what Richard wants? Perhaps once he's arrested, the kidnappers will miraculously get back in touch with Richard and return the baby unharmed. Because despite what Richard says in front of Anne, Marco knows Richard wants him hung out to dry for this. He wants Marco to go to jail, but doesn't want to look like he's the one who turned him in. Fine. Call the police, Marco says. Anne starts to cry. Her mother rubs her back. Richard reaches for his cell phone. It's late, but I'm sure Detective Razvak won't mind coming out, he says. Marco knows he is about to be arrested. He needs a lawyer. A good one. There's still some equity in the house, if Anne will agree to let him mortgage it further. But why would any woman agree to mortgage her house to defend her husband on charges of kidnapping their own child? Even if she were willing, her father would dissuade her. As if reading Marco's mind, Richard says, I need hardly tell you that we won't be paying for your defense. They wait in tense silence for the detective to arrive. Alice, who would normally busy herself making tea for everyone, doesn't even budge from the sofa. Marco is desolate. Richard has won, the manipulative bastard. Anne has fallen into the family fold one last time, and forever. As long as she stands by her parents, everything will work out for her. Richard will find a way to return her baby to her. He will be a hero. They'll take care of her, and the baby, financially, while Marco rots in prison. All she has to do is sacrifice him. She has made her choice. He doesn't blame her. At last the doorbell rings. Everyone jumps. Richard gets up to answer the door while the others remain sitting stone-faced in the living room. Marco decides that he will confess everything. Then, after Cora's safe return, he'll tell the police about Richard's role in all of this. They may not believe him, but surely they can investigate him. Maybe they can find a connection between Richard and Derek Honig. But Marco is pretty sure that Richard will have covered his tracks. Richard ushers Detective Razvak into the living room. The detective seems to take in the situation at a glance. He looks at Anne, weeping in her mother's arms at one end of the large sofa, Marco sitting at the other end. Marco knows how he must look to the detective. Pale and sweating, he must look like an absolute wreck. Richard offers the detective a chair and says, I'm sorry. I know you don't like it when we deal with the kidnappers and don't tell you until after the fact, but we were afraid to do anything else. Razvak looks grim. You say they phoned you? Yes, yesterday. I made arrangements to meet them with the additional money earlier this evening, but they didn't show. Marco watches Richard. Wonders what the hell he's doing. Phoned him?
Either Richard is lying to the police or he's lying to Marco and Anne. When is he going to tell the detective that Marco was the one who took Cora from the house? Razbeck reaches into his jacket and takes out his notebook. He carefully writes down everything Richard tells him. Richard says nothing about Marco. He doesn't even look at Marco. Is this all for Anne? Marco wonders. Is he showing her that he's deliberately protecting Marco, even though they know what he did? What is Richard's game here? Maybe Richard never had any intention of telling the police what Marco did. He just wanted to watch him twist in the wind. The absolute bastard. Or is he waiting for Marco to throw himself on his sword, to see if he's got the guts to do it? Is this a test? One he must pass in order to get Cora back? Is that everything? Razbeck says finally, standing up, flipping his notebook closed. I think so, Richard says. He plays the part of the concerned parent and grandparent perfectly, smooth as glass, a practiced liar. Richard sees the detective to the door while Marco slumps back in the sofa, exhausted and confused. If this was a test, he has just failed it. Anne meets his eyes for only a moment, then looks away. Richard returns to the living room. There, now do you believe me? He says to Marco. I destroyed the note to protect you. I just lied to the police. I told him the kidnappers called me to protect you. I didn't tell them about the note and the cell phone sent to me, both of which incriminated you. I'm not the bad guy here, Marco. You are. Anne pulls away from her mother's embrace and stares at Marco. Although I don't know why I do it, Richard adds. I don't know why you married this guy, Anne. Marco needs to get out of here so he can think. He doesn't know what Richard is up to. Come on, Anne. Let's go home, he says. Anne has turned away again and doesn't look at him. Anne? I don't think she's going anywhere, Richard says. Marco's heart sinks at the thought of going home without Anne. Evidently, Richard doesn't want him to go to jail. Perhaps Richard doesn't want the public humiliation of having a convicted criminal for a son-in-law. Maybe the whole time all he wanted was for Anne to know what kind of man Marco was, to separate them. It looks as though he's succeeded. They all look at him, as if waiting for him to leave. Marco senses the hostility and reaches for his cell to call a cab. When his cab arrives, he is surprised when the three of them follow him outside, perhaps to make sure he leaves. They stand in the drive, watching him go. Marco looks back at his wife, her father and mother on either side of her. He cannot read her expression. Marco thinks, "She will never come home to me again. I'm all alone." Razbeck is uneasy on the drive back from the Dreese's mansion. He has a lot of unanswered questions, the most important one being this: where is the missing baby? He seems no closer to a solution. He thinks about Marco, the haunted look on his face. Marco was exhausted, spent. Not that Razbeck feels any particular sympathy for him, but he knows there's more to this than meets the eye, and he wants to find out what it is. Razbeck has been suspicious of Richard Dreese almost from the start. To his mind, perhaps it's a prejudice, stemming from Razbeck's own working-class background, nobody makes that much money without taking advantage of somebody. It's much easier to make money if you don't care who you hurt. If you have scruples, it's much harder to get rich. As far as Razbeck's concerned, Marco doesn't fit the profile of a kidnapper. To Razbeck, Marco has always seemed like a desperate man thrown up against the wall, someone who might do the wrong thing if pushed to it. Richard Dreese, however, is a savvy businessman, a man of considerable wealth which, rightly or wrongly, raises all sorts of red flags for Razbeck. Sometimes these people have a kind of arrogance that makes them think they're above the law. Richard Dreese is a man who bears watching, which is why Razbeck has put a wiretap on his phones. He knows that the kidnappers have not phoned him. Richard is lying. He decides to also have a couple of officers quietly watch the house. 35. In her own bedroom, she and Richard have had separate bedrooms for years now, Alice paces back and forth on the plush carpet. She has been married to Richard for a very long time. She wouldn't have believed this of him only a couple of years ago. But now he is a man with all kinds of secrets. Horrible, unforgivable secrets, if what she's just heard is true. She has known for some time that Richard has been seeing another woman. It wasn't the first time he'd cheated on her.